From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. Sponsored by Bio-Rad. Find your perfect match among the full line of Bio-Rad thermocyclers and real-time PCR instruments, plastics, and reagents. On the web at www.bio-rad.com/genomics. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Dr. Jeffrey Stevenson from the ARUP Institute for Clinical and Experimental Pathology about using quantitative real-time PCR in a clinical reference laboratory.
Dr. Jeffrey Stevenson is a senior scientist at the ARUP Institute for Clinical and Experimental Pathology. The Institute is developing novel diagnostics for clinical and anatomic pathology in a wide range of disciplines. It is part of ARUP Laboratories, which is a national reference laboratory owned by the University of Utah. Dr. Stevenson, how common is the use of quantitative real-time PCR in clinical reference laboratories?
Quantitative real-time PCR, I guess it's often referred to as real-time PCR, quantitative PCR, kinetic PCR, kind of depending on whatever lab you grew up in. It's probably the most common PCR platform in reference labs today. Traditional end detection platforms like gel detection and EIA plate detection are pretty rapidly being replaced by real-time technology. So while most of the testing still is being done qualitatively, as its name implies, it is inherently a quantitative technology, and so a subset of testing is done quantitatively. So for us in the clinical reference lab, qPCR really is the bread and butter of infectious disease testing. But it's also now being routinely used in many small hospital labs, and probably in the near future, you'll probably see a little small real-time PCR machine in your doctor's office. And we're actually seeing this all the time. At ARUP, our clients are hospitals, and so we actually encourage this migration of tests out of our lab into the smaller hospital labs as they become technically competent. So our belief is really to get the testing as close to the patient as feasible. Now, although detection alone is all that's necessary for many of our viral targets, in some instances, there really is a tremendous clinical utility for quantitative testing. So people use viral load testing for predicting disease progression, predicting therapeutic efficiency, monitoring therapy. You know, I'll digress a little bit of history here. In the late 1990s, a number of commercial tests became available that made a huge and immediate clinical impact. So we saw things like HIV testing, hepatitis B, hepatitis C. And I think at that time, the expectation was this is just the beginning of this rollout of a number of quantitative tests. Funny thing is that these early expectations really didn't materialize. And in the last 10 years, remarkably very little has changed. If you look in 2006, the commercial quantitative test menu is essentially the same with just the addition of CMV. You know, probably this is that to roll out a test like this from a major company costs a lot of money, and so they really target high-volume tests. So the bottom line is for most infectious disease targets, if you want to do a real-time qPCR assay, particularly if you want this to be quantitative, you really need to do this yourself. And so this is why, to a large extent, lab-developed assays are still mostly done in reference labs, and this isn't just a matter of money, but really probably more importantly, it requires a level of technical expertise that is often not present in small labs. That being said, the migration of this technology into small labs is happening, so it won't be the sole domain of the large reference labs in the near future.
Why is qPCR such an attractive technology for a clinical reference lab? What are its major advantages?
So its advantages, it has the same advantage of the traditional gel detection PCRs, that it's very sensitive. If you're able to get a single copy of your target into a PCR reaction, in most cases you should be able to detect that. However, it is more specific. You know, your specificity in traditional PCR is imparted by the primer sequences. With real-time PCR, you get this additional layer of specificity when you use a probe that needs to bind to your amplified material. So not only, you know, you will only see amplified material that contains the probe binding sequence. And thirdly, if you use hybridization probes, You actually have the ability then to do post-amplification melting analysis. You can't do these with the hydrolysis probes that many people use because the probe is consumed during the reaction. Real-time PCR is also much more rapid. Instead of having to run your PCR and then wait till it's done, put it in a gel, essentially we're doing amplification and detection simultaneously. So some instruments can actually do a full real-time PCR reaction in less than 30 minutes. Actually, the nucleic acid extraction times are often the rate-limiting factor. So there's less hands-on time. It's much more amenable to automation. You can just envision it's a lot easier to program, you know, a robot to pipette into a 96-well plate than it is to try to get it to pipette into, you know, a gel box or into a, you know, agarose gel. There's particularly for reference labs, one of the advantages is much higher throughput. You have 96 well, I've even seen 384 well plates, makes it much more cost effective, and we can even increase our cost effectiveness. You know, at ARUP, we've actually made all our DNA real-time assays, we've standardized all the cycling parameters. So every real-time assay, you know, cycles the same, it can be put on the same run, so we can run HSV, CMV, mycoplasma, et cetera, all together, so we're not running half plates, partial plates. Great space saving. You know, it's not a scientific issue, but administrators really love the fact that you can, you know, we used to have a gel bench probably 20 feet long, just full of little gel boxes. And so we're now able to get in about a 3-foot by 3-foot footprint. Something that's really important, particularly for infectious disease, is that it's a closed system. You know, one of our biggest fears is contamination because, you know, you're amplifying material. You know, something that's amplified on Tuesday can contaminate a reaction the next day. And since it's an infectious disease, for most of our tests, the majority of our samples are negative. You know, there's a big concern about contaminating another reaction. And so, you know, the fact that we never open these tubes and pipette this amplified material around is a big bonus for us. And like I mentioned before, it does have the potential to provide quantitative data.
With these advantages, what potential pitfalls need to be kept in mind when using qPCR in a clinical reference lab?
You know, I think that one of the biggest things is just a failure to recognize the difficulties and limitations. Because it's relatively new, people look at this as it's new and it's got to be better. You know, the first thing I point out to people is that this is not necessarily more sensitive than gel detection. If you have a well-optimized assay, traditional or real-time PCR, in our experience, we've seen that they have approximately equal sensitivity. So real-time isn't necessarily more sensitive. You know, it has its other advantages, and there's always a trade-off. There are also, you know, there's increased design constraints. So you can imagine trying to design an assay with just two primers. Well, if you want to now add in a probe or two probes, it becomes a little more complex, particularly with viral targets where there's a lot of sequence variation. And that sort of gets to the third point, is that real-time assays are probably more sensitive or more vulnerable to sequence polymorphisms within the region that you're amplifying. And you have a sequence, you have a SNP underneath a primer, you know, it typically has less effect on the reaction than if you put a sequence polymorphism underneath the probe. Now, I just want to talk a minute on some of the pitfalls that are specific to just quantitative assays. So although the commercial test menu has not changed much in the past 10 years, what has changed is the introduction and routine use of real-time PCR in the clinical lab. So most labs now have the capability to develop a qualitative PCR assay. And the thinking is, okay, if we want this to be a quantitative assay, we just get our hands on some calibrator, you make a standard curve, and voila, we have a quantitative assay. And this apparent simplicity really is enticing, and it was to us as well. Unfortunately, the assays are really poorly standardized. You know, the assays aren't necessarily bad, but each lab chooses their own calibrator. So there is no generally accepted quantitative gold standard like we have for HIV or hepatitis C. So you can see where this is going. Since assays are developed in many different labs and with different standard materials, results can be all over the board. You know, in our experience, the difficulty in obtaining an accurate calibrator and then maintaining that in some stable state is probably the biggest challenge to accurate and reproducible quantitation. I recently saw an unpublished study where a transplant lab sent out patient samples to a number of different reference labs, and when they got the results back, you know, it was, I don't know if it was unexpected, it was a little bit shocking that they saw up to three log differences on the same samples from lab to lab. So this is a thousandfold difference on the same sample. And even within lab, they saw 3 to 10-fold differences on replicate samples. And we just recently participated in a similar study looking at Epstein-Barr virus, and we saw the same thing. So this isn't some isolated occurrence. So the obvious question is if developing a real-time quantitative assay really is as simple as it seems, why is the huge variation between labs? And, you know, the answer is this is just not as simple as it appears. And I think what we're seeing now is that the difficulties and nuances in developing a quantitative assay are really only becoming fully appreciated.
Now, to some extent, you've anticipated my next question, that qPCR used to be a difficult and labor-intensive undertaking. But what's changed to make it more user-friendly?
You know, and in the old days, you know, what they did was quantitation by competitive PCR. Now, I won't go into the details, but essentially you take your patient sample and then you spike that with varying amounts of a known competitor, and then you amplify all, you know, probably 10 reactions, you put them on a gel, and you look to sort of see, well, where did I get equal amplification of both targets, and that is the, you know, that was your quantitative value. And you know, I looked at this and thought, well, anything's going to be better than that. But, you know, things that have made this a little more user-friendly is that there's an explosion of online assay design software. And so, you know, anybody can go on, and mostly it's free, and it helps you design assays. The analysis software on most of the instruments is much better than it used to be. You know, we have 96 well plates. We have robotics for assay setup. You know, there are much better nucleic acid extraction chemistries because, you know, with PCR, you're always concerned about PCR, you know, inhibitors of the PCR, particularly that come out of patient samples. There's a wider variety of amplification master mixes available, and they're also off-the-shelf assays. So previously, if you were doing something outside the big four of HIV, hepatitis, or CMV, these had to be developed in your own lab. And there's also a greater variety of instrumentation. You know, you have your very high-throughput instruments all the way down to where you can run individual reactions. They have instruments where you have 16 different wells, and you can actually program 16 different PCR reactions going on simultaneously. So the bottom line is that you have more choices, and so you really can find a better fit for your lab's needs.
Can you talk about how you rely on qPCR for detecting viral pathogens in your lab, and how you go about validating the data for these assays?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when I first got here in 2001, I think just about every assay we did was traditional gel detection. So we started out just by upgrading our high-volume testing to real-time PCR, and that was our herpes simplex and our cytomegalovirus assays. And also we started just doing qualitative assays only. You know, what we wanted to do was gain a familiarity with the platform and sort of see all the problems that might arise before we started doing quantitative testing. And, you know, now all our new assays are in a real-time format. There's nothing that we would consider going back and doing by gel. So when we want to validate an assay, probably the first thing we do once we've gone through the design phase is that we, roughly estimate the analytical sensitivity of the assay. So usually what we do is we have the amplicon cloned into a plasmid, and what we're looking for, we'll do log dilutions and look for a high PCR efficiency. Secondly, what we usually test to make sure that our internal control does not interfere or does not in any way affect the sensitivity of the assay. Then we check for accuracy. So normally what we'll do is we will run a number of patient samples, you know, 20 to 30 for each sample type that we're validating. You know, our first choice would be to have actual patient samples that had been previously run by another method. Sometimes that just is not possible. Our second choice would be that we would purchase organisms somewhere and we would spike those into negative plasma, serum, et cetera, at low, medium, and high levels. And finally, sort of our last choice is occasionally you get an organism that you just can't get, whether it's H5N1, controlled substance. And so we actually do have the leeway to use spike nucleic acids. We do a limit of detection, so essentially we just spike into each sample type and, you know, do serial dilutions down until we can no longer detect. So we have at least something that we can tell the clinician we're able to pick up down to 200 copies per mil. We do precision and reproducibility, both between run and within run, and then finally we test for specificity across reactivity. So we look for either organisms that are closely related by sequence or in the same family, or we will look, for instance, if we're doing a respiratory virus, we'll look for other viruses or bacteria that typically reside in the same body fluid. For quantitative assays, essentially it's the same, but we just add a linearity. So we'll look at the linearity for each analyte in each sample type. And just a word of advice, when we did our first quantitative assay, we chose a very low volume test. It was HHV6, and what this did, it allowed us to work out most of the problems we were going to see before we went to some high volume testing.
What are the key points to consider when you're working on the development of an accurate and reproducible quantitative real-time PCR assay?
So in general, just, you know, for qPCR in general, the biggest thing you can do is an extensive upfront sequence analysis. You can really save yourself a lot of headache if you look at as many sequences as possible, because sequence polymorphisms can really confound one of these assays. For a recent example, we did an assay for flu A, and I think over approximately 1,600 different sequences were evaluated. Now this is, you know, that's sort of at the high end because it's an RNA target, and, you know, RNA viruses, the reverse transcriptase lacks proofreading, and so it has a lot more sequence variation. But the more sequence you can look at before you start, the better off you're going to be. The next thing is that the more real patient samples you can test, the better off you're going to be. There's nothing like, you know, a patient sample to mess up a really nice assay. And so when you test real patient samples, you are able to, you get different matrices, you probably get different variants of the virus. For our biggest concern for quantitative assays is that your assay is only going to be as accurate as the accuracy of your calibrator material. So they do have commercial quantitative material available for many viruses, you know, either both purified DNA or whole virus, or even that, just because you bought it from a commercial source is no guarantee for accuracy. A colleague of mine, you know, they had a plasmid that they'd quantitated, and then they went and bought two different commercial sources of CMV virus. One of them was a log higher than theirs, one was a log lower than theirs. So there's no really telling what is the accurate, you know, which one of these is accurate. So to get an accurate and reproducible test is really dependent on generating an accurate and reliable standard curve, and this can be a big challenge. So, you know, if your standard concentration is changing, typically what it does is it just gradually deteriorates. This can really play havoc with your ability to accurately quantitate. And we think this is the major source of variability in assays from institution to institution. So the approach we've used is we lyophilize all our calibrators. So we get a calibrator, we compare it, and then we lyophilize. And we're fortunate here at ARUP that we have a big reagent lab. We have two lyophilizers available to us. But the lyophilized hepatitis C standards for the WHO have been stable at room temperature for 5 years. So this has really been very successful for us. Currently, we lyophilize all our standards and our controls for all our qPCR assays. And I don't think I can overemphasize how much improvement this has provided. You know, we started out, we couldn't get a standard curve to last for more than, you know, a week before it started to deteriorate. So this has been, you know, sort of manna from heaven for us.
My final question is, are there any improvements you would like to see in qPCR technology that would make it even more valuable in a clinical reference laboratory?
So one thing I'd like to see, and these are things that are sort of in the works, and we're getting responses from commercial companies, but an improved signal to background ratio. You know, hydrolysis probe assays have a very high signal to noise because they, you know, they hydrolyze and release probe into the reaction, and they have very high signal to noise. Whereas hybridization assays typically aren't as good, but we're seeing improvement. Another thing is an expanded menu of modified bases. So you can, you know, if you have a sequence polymorphism and it's a sequence, it's something that you've seen in the literature, you can put in bases that are neutral bases that can accommodate these sequence variants. And so, you know, that's something I'd like to be able to see. But this is something we are seeing progress, and we're talking to companies that are able to provide some of these for us. As far as quantitation, I mean, the biggest thing is, we need to have some kind of standardization of calibrators like we see with HIV and HCV. You know, there I've participated in a number of different groups, but, you know, the going is just really slow. But what this will allow us to do then is it provides greater consistency in between lab testing. Right now, if you have a test, a quantitative test done at one lab, it would be foolish to then go and move from, you know, lab A to lab B to lab C, because you don't know, you know, if they're looking for a rise or a decline in the viral load, you know, you're probably going to see much greater variability between labs than you would actually, you know, in the patient in response to therapy. So as far as quantitative assays, I think that was going to be the biggest change for us in the near future.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Do you have an opinion on this week's podcast? If so, we'd like to read it. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and give us your thoughts. We also invite you to answer the following question. What improvements would you like to see in qPCR technology that might make it more valuable in a clinical reference laboratory? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.